We'll hear arguments next in 1844, City of Mobile against Bolden and the Consolidated Case. I think we may proceed now whenever you're ready, Mr. Ryan.
Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please the Court. The issue in the case that I present to you is whether Mobile's election system, under which it elects its commissioners in at-large elections, is constitutional. Now, Mobile is a city of 190,000 people. One-third of them are black. There has never been a black commissioner elected. And I think that the ultimate issue that is presented to this court in this case is whether or not these blacks, who are the plaintiffs in this case, are deprived of the equal protection of the laws. Are they deprived of equal access and equal participation in the election system of Mobile, as they allege in their complaint?
Can you tell me, Mr. Ryan, I know the commissioner form of municipal government is a very common one, but it's one with which I have only a passing familiarity. Commissioners have both executive and legislative powers?
Yes, they do. That's the big distinction between the commission form of government and, the mayor council. Each commissioner is elected as the finance commissioner, the safety commissioner, the public works commissioner.
That specialization has been true only fairly recently. The commission form of government, as I remember from reading the briefs, began in Mobile in 1911, was it?
Yes, it did.
And the specialization, at least officially, the specialization is more recent, isn't it?
I believe that, as a matter of fact, the specialization, insofar as prescribed by law, was laid out in 1965.
Right.
But, Mr. Justice Stewart, I think it has always...
It's always been de facto specialization.
Yes. Anyone who ran for the commission, say, I'm running for the finance post because I'm an expert in finance. I'm running for the police or safety post because I'm an expert in police. Or I'm running for the public works department because I am an expert in that. I guess the big difference between the commission form, which is more like the city manager form than any other kind.
Unlike it, too.
It is.
Am I then correct in understanding that all of the legislative power and all of the executive power of the municipality reside in these three commissioners?
That is true. That is true.
All of the powers. The manager for the government, of course, the city manager is exclusively an executive.
Yeah, that's right.
And the council is the legislature.
That is right. And when I was saying that when they do the administrative executive work, they're more like city managers.
But they also enact the ordinances, do they?
They also enact the ordinances. But the people know which of the three are responsible for each of the functions of the city. And as of necessity, this form of government, which began around the turn of the century, was elected to wipe out the corruption Mayor Alderman form that was causing a lot of problems at that time. And it gives each commissioner absolute responsibility to each voter. And
you've just explained that the people run on a place basis here in Mobile. Now, it seems to me that I grew up in a place where we had the commission form of government, but each one was appointed by the mayor to the public works or public safety or what it was. But here, the candidates run for a specific position.
Yes, Your Honor, that's true. I think one of the really great things about the field of municipal government, and I've been in it since 1937, is every city is different when you come right down to it. You can't say that one city is precisely like another. I don't care how you go about it and how you describe it.
But isn't there a common denominator in terms of having them exercise, as Mr. Justice Stewart suggested, both executive and legislative functions?
Yes.
That's the common denominator of the commission's form, isn't it?
Yes, it is. And they have to adopt the policies and then carry them out. But I think the major thing is that the people know when they vote for them that they're voting for this man because he's an expert in finance, and this man, he's an expert in police safety, and this man because he's an expert in public works. And regardless of whether or not they run as such, as they did not prior to 1965, it was always understood this man was running for this post and that man was running for that post.
May I ask another question? Do they run as a trio on a ticket? I know it's a nonpartisan election, at least that's my understanding.
That's right. It is a nonpartisan election.
First of all, what is the term of a commissioner?
4 years.
And are they all elected at the same time?
Yes, they are.
And do they run as a slate of three?
No. No. There is no primary. It's a nonpartisan election. And there are no impediments to anybody registering, anybody qualifying to be a candidate for any one of the places, even though they're not an expert in finance or an expert in one of the others. And there's no question but what. There's equal participation in the electoral process, and that the votes are counted equally.
And have Negroes been, they have run?
Yes. Now, Negroes have run. Three Negroes ran in 1973.
They ran or they stood for election?
Mr. Justice Marshall, I would say in the South they stood for election. And you're right. They stood for election in 1973, but as the district court pointed out, they were young, inexperienced, and ran rather limited campaigns and didn't even care the black wards. Now,
is there some prerequisites for getting on the ballot?
None whatever.
There isn't a filing fee, I suppose, sometimes.
There was a minor
filing. But there's not a signature requirement.
There must be.
Now, Mr. Arundel is here. He's the great expert that tried to make an expert on me, but I'm saying there isn't.
There is no signature requirement of any substance?
No, absolutely not. So anybody can run. Now, this is the first case that I know of that comes before this court that really squarely involves at-large elections in the municipal level.
Well, Mr. Ryan, before you go on with that, you might just tell me why you thought it was important to say that these commissioners either formally or informally stood for election for certain positions.
Yes.
Now, let's just assume that they didn't. Would your case be different? Let's suppose they just ran, all they ran was for three commissioners, and no one ever knew what they were running for except they were running for commissioners, and they had the full legislative power. It might so happen that after they were elected, one would assume this kind of executive responsibility, and one would assume another. But suppose they just ran. When they ran, no one understood anything other than that they were running for three commissioners exercising legislative power. Would your case be different or not?
That's a pretty hard question, but I would say that my case would not be different, because in every commission form of government that I know of, the people always know who that commissioner is running for and who they're voting for. Now, you've had a lot of experience in Cincinnati with proportional representation and voting and such. But I say, coming back to my point, that this is the first case before this court involving at-large election. We have 67% of the cities.
Well, I take it that your case would be the same if there was just at-large election for a city councilman.
I would agree, except I think here you have a special reason, because the people can better hold these commissioners responsible for their actions because they know who takes the action.
So you do want us to confine our decision to address the
commission form of government.
Commission,
yes.
Form of government where you run for a spot.
Yes.
The city, yes, council, generally speaking, as a generality, has only legislative power.
That is right.
Not executive power.
That is right. And you have a city manager, you have a mayor who runs the overall.
I want to suggest to you that the commission form of government, as you described in Mobile, is certainly very different from the commission form of government as we knew it in New Jersey. My father was for 13 years a member of the city commission of Newark. And there, you had as many as 80 candidates, and the first five were elected, and then the five of them, by majority vote, decided which should be director of public safety, which should be director of public affairs, and so forth. And one did not run because he was supposed to be an expert in any particular field.
Now, you're speaking of a county, are you not?
No, I am not. I'm speaking of the city of New York. We had the commission form of government in New Jersey for some 25 years in most of the major cities.
Have the commission form. Yes. Well.
Well, that takes me back to my comment. It's the mayor who made the assignment of the places. So there are, as you pointed out, all variations, but I join Mr. Justice White in asking whether your case would be the same without a place contest standing for a place.
Well, I think that on reconsideration, I would say it would be the same. I think that the election at large is the important thing here, and it is true, though, that there is a tremendous battle about the qualifications of the various commissioners, because I, too, Mr. Justice Brennan, grew up, and my father ran, and that's too long ago. I don't remember how many candidates, but this was county and not city. And so I think
you indicated before that the distinguishing factor, perhaps, was that these people exercised both legislative and executive functions, and
that's right.
Differed. That sort of distinguished it from
the usual mayor council form of government. That is very
police,
true.
What about the police jury in Texas and Louisiana?
Now,
the county police jury.
Mr. Justice,
you talk about everything different all over the world with that.
That's right. And
the judge is a layman in Texas.
And the judge is a layman
in the jury.
In Missouri, where President Truman was.
That's right.
And a judge is a layman in Illinois. But let me get back to this fact. One of the most interesting things to me is that these plaintiffs have brought this suit. They have 35% black, but never has a qualified black run for office in Mobile. Now, if there's any one thing that this court can judicially notice, and that Mr. Justice Marshall knows better than anybody else, that it's this. When I first started representing cities in 1937, there wasn't a single black that I know of on any city council, and certainly no black mayors. Today, we have a tremendous number.
Mr. Ryan, how can you know whether a particular individual, black or white, is, quote, qualified, close quote?
Well, he has to state his qualifications, and the people vote for him on the basis of his qualifications. He puts forth his qualifications in the race.
Well, if I might be anecdotal, too, I grew up in Milwaukee. We had a city council of 23 members. 12 of them were tavern keepers.
Well, the city council of Milwaukee doesn't really run the city. The mayor, who was Mayor Holm probably then, and a city manager generally run the city. But the thing is that here you've got Mayor Bradley running out in Los Angeles in a city that's 17% black.
He ran once, he was defeated. He ran next time, he was elected. And he'd be elected over and over again. And I say around this nation, and we cite them on page 11 and 12 of our brief, good many illustrations. Raleigh, North Carolina, 22% black, black mayor. Got a black mayor of Atlanta, black mayor of New Orleans, black mayor of Newark, black mayor of Oakland. I could name 100 of them almost because I work with them almost daily. And I'm saying that we've reached the point in our nation where the color of a man's skin in the political area doesn't count as much as his ability to prove that he can do the job.
Why is it that he has Mobile?
I didn't quite hear.
Are they all stupid in Mobile?
Now, Mr. Justice Marshall, you probably knew John LaFleur very well. He's one of the ablest Americans who ever lived. I'm sorry, he was a plaintiff here. He's dead. Now, I would be awfully hard to convince that if John LaFleur ran with 35% black, that he wouldn't get enough white votes to win. And my statement to you is... Pardon?
He was a mail carrier.
Well, he was a brilliant man.
Well, he wasn't a politician. He was a mail carrier.
But he's a politician, too, and you know it.
Yeah, well, that's a part-time politician.
Well,
he organized some of those young lawyers down in Mobile.
He organized the only slating organization that existed in Mobile, the Nonpartisan Voters League, which is BLACK.
Well, if the qualification factor is relevant here at all, qualification is that the three Negroes who ran, you said according to this record, did not carry the Negro
wards.
Voting wards. And isn't that about all we can deal with on qualifications?
Well, Your Honor, I think it shows the sophistication of the voters today. And I think it also shows that the voters are looking at the qualifications of the candidates rather than the color of their skin. They would have gotten 35% of the vote.
The difficulty that in this case, though, I know you talk about the rest of the country, but in this case, the district court's findings are, as I remember them, that the color of a man's skin is of critical importance in the election.
Quote, the kiss of death, end quote.
Don't we have to look at Mobile rather than Oakland and Cleveland and other places?
Well, I read The Kiss of Death, Mr. Justice Marshall, and I read what the judge said about polarization.
But do we accept those findings or do we not for purposes of our decision?
I say that the findings are based on mighty thin evidence because the expert testified that polarization was lessening all the time. And there were witnesses who testified that a black man would have a reasonable opportunity to win.
Do we accept those findings for purposes of our decision, or do you ask us to re-examine them?
I ask you to re-examine them because...
Is it critical to your case that we re-examine them?
Not particularly. I think that what you have here is a legal conclusion rather than a fact, because what did the court do? In a voting rights case, you've got to find some barrier, some obstacle. Now, in Mobile, you have full access, full participation by blacks.
Yes, but Mr. Justice Stevens points out that the district court said you may have complete access until the voters get into the voting booth. And then there's voting on the basis of color. And no black has ever been elected.
Well,
now, let's just assume that's so.
That is true.
So let's just assume that that is the, that is the, just accept those findings. What do you say to that?
I say to that the evidence is that polarization is growing less and less all the time, and that this court must pay some attention to the fact that blacks
throughout the nation. What if we accept the findings that there is racial voting at the polls?
Mr. Ryan, on your polarization changes, what about the Klan getting 1,500 members a week in Alabama? The Ku Klux Klan I'm talking about, you know, KKK.
Yeah, I've heard of it.
1,500 members a week in Alabama in the last 2 months.
I don't follow its activities quite as close, I'm afraid.
Well, it's in the newspaper.
Well,
local ones.
I
I would say that the Ku Klux Klan, as far as I know of it, is fading as a factor in the South, just as polarization of the black vote is fading.
I thought your argument, Mr. Ryan, was that even accepting polarization, nothing in either the 14th or 15th Amendment requires that this at-large form of election, which has been the form adopted by Mobile since the year 1911, to be altered.
Well,
even accepting that Negroes vote as Negroes and the white voters vote as white people.
My position is
nothing in the Constitution, the 14th Amendment or the 15th Amendment or any other part of it that requires Alabama to change its system of voting.
That is right. I think as long as they have equal access and equal participation and their votes are counted equally, that's all the Constitution requires. And they have that. In
no one man, one vote problem here under the 14th Amendment.
Well, they're all equal.
And there's no deprivation of anybody's voting under the 15th Amendment based on his race or color.
That is right, because testimony is this, that the black vote is decisive. All the candidates for commissioner campaigned very hard for the black vote. And on pages 141, 142, 143, you have Reverend Hope saying that he feels, he's head of the Nonpartisan Voters League, he feels that the three white candidates, or three white commissioners who now occupy those offices, treat the blacks very well. And we have over and over again the fact that these commissioners have the open door policy, they see the blacks, they try to take care of their problem. Sure, they can't take care of them all. All cities have problems. But
did not the district court find that the blacks were not getting the same services from their government that the whites were? Isn't that the district court's finding?
Well, the finding on services, there are other remedies for that, Mr.
Well, I understand
Justice
that,
Stevens.
I'm not saying you necessarily...
That doesn't have anything with the voting.
Don't we have to deal with the findings of the district court rather than changing conditions that you described that are taking place today? Or do we?
I think
deal with the findings the district court made, and we've got to live with them.
I don't think you can decide this case in a vacuum. I think you have to look at the entirety of the picture of what's going on in the world today. I think that in this instance where there's no impediment in the voting process, whatever, everybody can register, everybody can run.
Do you think the Gamillion case would have been decided differently if there had been a showing that there was no impediment to the voting process?
Well, the Gamillion case is entirely different from this. The Gamillion case was an out-and-out discriminatory action.
Suppose this was out-and-out in the sense that the legislature and the commissioner said, the reason we want to maintain our plan, our commission form of government, is because we do not want blacks to be elected as commissioners. Would it be a different case?
It could be, but you don't have that here. You don't have any intentional discrimination. You have absolute equality of voters.
Well,
to the voting process.
Based on the findings of the district court, you at some point in the process, you have a deliberate discrimination in the voting booth.
Well,
I'm not suggesting that, but I'm just...
Mr. Justice White, there's no such finding.
I'll call it polarization then.
Well,
racial voting, whatever you want to call it.
Well, even on that, I say that the testimony was by the expert, Boyles, that polarization is lessening, and the government, in its brief, concedes that race was not an issue in the 1973 election, which was the last election. Now, the district court did, was it couldn't find an obstacle, it couldn't find any impediment, and found that everybody had an unfettered right to vote. So what it did was, and I quote the court concludes that an at-large system is an effective barrier to blacks seeking public life. Well, that simply isn't true.
Does not the record here... Is not the record here that so the three Negro candidates didn't carry the Negro wards in conflict to some extent with the district court's finding?
Absolutely. And then the Court of Appeals went a step further and said that that existence of that so-called barrier to blacks seeking public life establishes the element of intent. Now, I think that this case is enormously important because having found that the system itself was the barrier, all the court could do was abolish it. And what did they do? They wrote an entire new city chart with a mayor and nine city councilmen because they said that the only way, and I quote this court again, that you can provide blacks with a realistic opportunity to elect blacks to the city governing body is to wipe out the existing government and put in a mayor council plan with single member districts. Now, I don't think this court's in the business of fixing elections or guaranteeing that a person is going to be able to vote and put in office a man of his own color. They have an equal right to an equal shot. One man, one vote.
Mr. Ryan, I suppose it's just the residential pattern that would allow the, that would afford the kind of a remedy the district court gave here. If blacks and whites were equally distributed around the city of Mobile, and yet the same results had occurred down in the past if there weren't any blacks elected, the only remedy would be a system of racial proportional representation. But this, the single-member district remedy would only work because of residential patterns, I take it.
Yeah, I think the vicious part, you're right, the vicious part of this decision is that it more or less freezes segregation.
You mean residential segregation?
Yes. If you're going to chop up Mobile into nine single-member districts and the blacks start moving out of the district, they lose control of it. So I think that's really, to me, we've reached the point, I say, when color shouldn't count. And it hasn't counted throughout the nation. And I think this court should say so, that you're not going to provide proportional representation by race. You never have. In decision after decision, you've said no. Equal vote, yes. Equal access, yes. Equal participation, yes. But not proportional representation by race.
In fact, proportional representation, that is the Hare system of proportional representation, has existed, I think, only in two municipalities in the United States, New York City for a while and Cincinnati, Ohio for a longer period. And that was attacked as being unconstitutional at one stage.
Yes. And it didn't work very well either place.
Well, one can argue about that.
All right, but Murray Stevenson, who put it in Cincinnati, told me it wasn't working very good, and so you got rid of it. But I'm saying that proportional representation by race is not guaranteed for the Constitution.
Yes.
The communists got elected every time.
I didn't quite understand you, Mr. Yeah, Justice.
In New York, the communists got elected every time.
In Cincinnati, I got elected.
You know, I thought in working on this case, really, one of the most interesting things was the footnote that Mr. Justice White wrote in Whitcomb versus Chavez, where he pointed out that a white man won in a black ward and a black man won in a white ward. And I hope that I have lived to see the day where that is America, because if you start carving up cities just because you've got to guarantee black seats on the governing board, you're going to have to carve up an awful lot of cities.
Mr. Blatcher?
Mr. Chief Justice, may it please the court. I would like to begin by responding, if I may, to some of the questions concerning the commission form of government in Mobile. Briefly, the history of commission government in Mobile, as Mr. Justice Stewart pointed out, began in 1911. The original statute did not require but did authorize the commissioners, once they were elected, to divide up the executive functions among themselves. And it certainly was the practice and custom in Mobile almost from the beginning for the commissioners to do this. In fact, it is not a matter of record in this case, but there was a lawsuit in the 1920s by some politicians who were unhappy that the commission had adopted that course rather than acting as a board of directors in common.
You mean that after their election, they then decided which of them would take what department?
That's correct. And in 1939, further my understanding, that the law was explicitly changed to provide for one place to be the mayor in advance of the election, and the two associate commissioners would be assigned the executive functions after the election. That plan also ran into some technical problems in the Alabama state courts, and it ended up in 1965, for the first time, the executive functions of the three commissioners were designated by law before they ran. We would like to point out that the plaintiffs in this case never objected to the retention of a commission form of government which permitted the use of single-member districts. It was the position of the defendant city in this case. From the time it filed its answer, through its arguments in the pretrial motions, the pretrial document, pretrial briefs, and on into the Court of Appeals, that the assignment of executive functions to the three commissioners absolutely foreclosed any remedy in this case. That, in fact, was, I think, a keystone of their defense. Based on their representations, which can also be found, by the way, in their answer on page 33 of the appendix, that in order for single-member districts to be provided in Mobile, a change in the form of government would have to come about. The court, acting in its equitable discretion, when it was forced to enter an order of its own, when the city of Mobile and the state of Alabama refused, after the court's invitation, to supply some legislative response to the infirmities of the at-large election system, then the court, taking the advice of the defendants themselves, changed to an optional form of government which is provided in the state of Alabama by other statutes. The state of Alabama has several optional forms of municipal government, including the now ancient mayor aldermanic form of government which Mobile was using back in 1900, including a new mayor council, a newer mayor council form that was devised specifically for Mobile in 1963, and including special legislation that governs Montgomery, for example, and Birmingham, which have adopted the so-called strong mayor that everyone in this trial agreed was preferable to the weak mayor, where the council could interfere in the day-to-day business of the executive. But to repeat, it is true that the plaintiffs, in the end, when asked to propose a remedy, suggested a change to a mayor council only because the defendants were urging that any other use of a form of government in the context of single-member districts would be inequitable and inappropriate in Mobile. The court's remedy leaves open to the state of Alabama the option of adopting by legislation a commission form of government that does permit of the use of single-member districts. That is still open to Alabama if it wishes to use it. But there has been no movement on the part of anyone in the legislature or in city government to seek or to bring about such a change.
Should the city do it unilaterally, or does it take state legislative action?
The city took the position from the beginning that it entirely lacked any authority to change its election system or its form of government, and that, in fact, we had to look to the legislature of Alabama for our remedy. It filed a motion to strike our prayer for relief that the election system be changed to single-member districts because they lacked the authority to provide that relief.
Well, is it your position that the discrimination in this case was effected in the voting booth? Is that where the...
Not exactly, Mr. Justice White. We do not take position that voters are somehow practicing a prohibited, constitutionally prohibited form of discrimination when they vote along racial lines. What our position is that given that situation, a situation, by the way, which has been reinforced by 100 years of official state action.
A city should not provide the kind of a system that makes effective that kind of voting, is that it?
That's absolutely correct. In Mobile, I doubt that one could devise an electoral form that more carefully and distinctly focused the electoral power of this
legislature. At large voting is just in a city, say, is out, is unconstitutional if over a period of time a substantial black or some other minority a group is without representation, that the court finds that there's discriminatory voting.
Polarized voting. Mm-hmm. We do not even say that every at-large system, under those circumstances, would have the prescribed effect. After all, as someone here pointed out, there were in a true at-large system, and as in this case, the top three vote getters would be elected, and you can have a plurality victories. Mm-hmm. And it may have been that under such a system, blacks in Mobile, representing 33% of the population, would have had
What would you do in this case if blacks and whites had been equally distributed throughout the city? What would have been your remedy?
Mr. Justice White, you're correct that we would have had no remedy through the districting formula. And in the first instance, we think that it's unrealistic to consider such a possibility, since if in fact blacks and whites were residentially homogenized throughout the entire district, it is unlikely that the social phenomenon of polarized racial voting would have occurred in the first instance. But if it did occur in that circumstance, I think it's clear that the election form, at-large voting, would not be the specific cause of the dilution of their vote, because, as you say, changing the districts would not provide them such a remedy. That issue, of course, is not presented here. The evidence was, and the court found, that Mobile was one of the most racially segregated cities in the country.
What inferences should be drawn, if any, from the fact that if you'd had district representation here, the three Negro candidates who ran would not have been elected in their own predominantly Negro districts?
Yes, sir. That was a factual issue that was debated at great length in the trial court. And all of the facts indicated in the trial court found, and the Court of Appeals affirmed its finding, that it was only one indication that no well-known, well-financed black candidate was even going to attempt a race in the city of Mobile, where all of the politicians, including the defendants, conceded that it took $30,000 to $50,000 to wage a successful campaign. When all the black politicians, including Mr. Flores, Nonpartisan Voters League, represented to the court that they would not even attempt to launch a black candidate given the pattern of racially polarized voting. This was a situation where the one champion of blacks' interests in the city of Mobile, a white commissioner named Joe Langan, had been defeated by that same racially polarized voting. His situation provided the centerpiece, I think, of the evidence in this case. And blacks in this case did not contend that they had a right to have a districting remedy that would permit them to elect blacks. They wished to elect a candidate of their choice. The evidence indicated they were not even permitted by the white majority to elect a white candidate who was at all connected with or interested in their concerns.
How were they prevented from doing it?
I beg your pardon, Mr.
You said the Negroes weren't allowed to elect the man of their own choice. And my question was, how were they denied that right?
They were denied that right by the black voting white majority operating in an at-large election system that involved a majority vote requirement.
Well, I understand from Mr. Ryan that maybe you can help him. He wants to know the constitutional provision that prevents white people from voting for white people and Negro and black people from voting for black people.
There is no such constitutional provision in the police court.
We agree with him on that.
We certainly do. Always have.
But you do say that given the fact of polarization as it's been referred to generally in the case, it does not require a finding of intent in the structuring of the governmental unit to discriminate?
That is the position we take. The Court of Appeals took the position that under the Equal Protection cause of action, such a finding of intent was required. At least the majority opinion did. And although it did sort of indicate that the intent would not be required under a 15th, well, I'm sorry, the majority did hold as well that the 15th Amendment would require a showing of intent. But it is our position, Mr. Justice Rehnquist, that neither the 14th Amendment, the 15th Amendment, certainly not the Voting Rights Act, requires that a districting system which operates to minimize or cancel out the voting strength of a protected minority requires a demonstration that that electoral system was motivated in the first instance or at any point in time by an invidious motive.
How about the election for the governor of Alabama?
Your Honor, the governor of Alabama is an executive function. It is one office. He must run statewide.
All the executive power of the government of Mobile is lodged in these three commissioners, I understand.
That's correct.
To that extent, there's no difference.
That's correct, except that what we don't foreclose is the possibility that a commission system could have been retained where all three would have elected, would have exercised the executive power and still have been elected from single-member districts and without violating the voting rights under the Equal Protection Clause of any of the citizens of Mobile who elected them from single-member districts. We say that that certainly is an option which is used in other cities, has not been challenged, and was not directly challenged in this case.
You think the Constitution, ultimately, what you're saying, as I understand it, is that the Constitution requires that one of these three commissioners be a Negro?
No, Mr.
Well,
Justice, sir, we're not.
That's the thrust of your argument, isn't it?
It is. We're saying that the Constitution requires that in a situation where there is block voting as powerful and as rigid as it is in Mobile, the Constitution requires that an electoral system be provided which gives blacks an opportunity to have their preferences registered in the election system. And their preference may or may not be a black candidate.
Voters don't always, many a time, I'm sure you've shared this experience with me and many of others of our fellow citizens, your preference hasn't been nominated by either party or any party.
That's correct.
So you're voting as between not first choices. Of yours.
Every voter doesn't have the right, of course, to have his preference registered on every occasion. But the concept of dilution grew out of this court's one person, one vote line of cases.
Yep, that's not involved here, is it?
The mathematical concept of one person, one vote
is
not.
Which is what that concept was in Reynolds against Sims.
That is not what Fortson versus Dorsey.
No, I know, but the original one person, one vote was purely a mathematical concept, wasn't it?
The specific concept in Reynolds was a mathematical concept.
Exclusively.
But the language of Reynolds is much broader than that, may it please the Court. And it talks about the right of every American citizen to have a full, undiluted, equally weighted vote. And from the beginning of that line of cases, this Court has recognized...
Well, now, go ahead, excuse me.
...has recognized that in laying down the rule that such a dilution or debasement of a person's vote could occur by a geographical apportionment scheme, by mathematics, as you say, that in providing a remedy for that, a state or a local government could go to an at-large election scheme.
Well, before you get to the question of remedy, let's talk about the question of constitutional violation. You say that it does not have to be by intent, I take it.
That is our position.
Now, supposing that instead of being roughly 65-35, was 85-15, and they had a long-standing three-commissioner at-large system, and could the district court then tell them that they had to go from three commissioners to five commissioners? Because even three commissioners split up geographically would not enable the Negro population to have a representative on the council.
If the system operated, given all of the premises of the hypothetical question, that there was rigid polarized voting, which strictly precluded, on every occasion, consistently over a period of time, the preferences of the 15% black minority from being registered in the at-large system, then it would be functionally no different than a districting system in which blacks were in one district that had no representatives and the whites were in one district that had all of the representatives. That's our position.
That you'd make the same argument about Catholics or Jews or any other
identifiable group that lived in some area, I suppose.
We
Italians, Poles, Hamtramcks?
We don't attempt to make that argument here, Mr. Justice White, but the argument might be made...
Sounds to me like you're making it.
The argument might be made under the precedence this Court has established if it could be shown by Catholics. And I would point out that in our experience, it has not been, as a matter of fact, possible to show this, that Catholics consistently voted as a block, that, or rather that the majority of non-Catholics voted as a block to defeat Catholic candidates over a period of time.
Well, that's a factual answer to my question. That isn't what I ask you.
Well, whether or not the case applies to Catholics or Poles or other groups is a question which simply, of course, requires additional consideration of other factors. But there can be no doubt that the 14th and the 15th Amendment was passed primarily to protect the voting rights of blacks.
The 15th
says so.
The 15th Amendment is explicit on that point.
Let me come back to what I suggested to you before about the fact that the three Negro candidates couldn't even carry their own districts. And you responded by saying that at least as I understood it, that the Negro leaders in the community knew that it was a futility to run, and so they didn't bother putting up good candidates. But that's a good deal of speculation. That's really not hard evidence. Your whole arguments about block voting are undermined by this reality that is in the record, that the Negroes didn't vote for Negro candidates.
Mr. Chief Justice, there was plenty of evidence in the record of where blacks had run in the city of Mobile for other governments, such as the school board, the legislature, had attempted time and again to seek election and had been defeated by a solid black vote by the majority of whites, as well as other white candidates, both in the city commission elections and in school board elections.
Who advocates a controversy with whom here?
The case or controversy is between the plaintiff class of black citizens of Mobile and the state of Alabama operating through its agency, the state of Mobile.
What case or controversy do the named plaintiffs have with the city of Mobile?
The case of controversy involves the lawfulness and the constitutionality.
Have they ever run? Ever wanted to run?
The evidence was that they have frequently run in the past. Had expressed a desire to run in the future.
These named plaintiffs?
John LaFleur, for one, ran for the state legislature as soon as the federal court in Montgomery provided single-member districts that provided him a reasonable opportunity to be elected. May it please the court, I would like to point out that contrary to Mr. Ryan's opening statement that this case is strictly an equal protection case, that there are at least four independent legal theory supporting the judgment below. The court is confronted with the findings of fact of two courts below that Mobile's at-large election system has not only the effect but the purpose, the motive of discriminating against black voters. Based on these findings, this court can affirm the judgments below. First, on the Voting Rights Act of 1965, which explicitly prohibits any election laws which have the purpose or effect of abridging blacks' voting rights. Secondly, on the 14th Amendment cause of action growing out of White versus Register, Whitcomb versus Chavez. And I would like to point out to this court, stopping there momentarily, that the evidence in this case is even stronger in all the critical aspects than was the evidence in White versus Register. Thirdly, the constitutional prohibition against any state law that is supported by a racial, invidious racial motive. And fourth, the 15th Amendment, which provides and proscribes any state law which has either the purpose or effect of abridging the voting rights of blacks. I think that...
Mr. Black, you're proposing in Chicago, the city council decided they didn't want any more Republicans, and they passed an at-large system there, which would effectively exclude Republicans from the city council. I suppose the Republicans are a group that are entitled to equal protection. Under your theory, would that be unconstitutional?
Your Honor, we simply don't take a position on whether or not Republicans are protected. In thinking about that question, it certainly occurs to me, first of all, that political parties are vehicles that we have in this society adopted as a convenient means for carrying on the political dialogue itself.
The significant thing about them, I suppose, is they vote as blocks.
They voted as blocks, that is correct. But the question is whether the vote against them is invidious in nature.
Well, it's because we don't want this members of this bloc in our legislature. Does that make it invidious?
No, sir. Certainly not on its face.
Then are you saying that a political party, that frankly a political party like the Republicans, are not entitled to they can be subjected to discrimination simply because they're Republicans?
I'm trying to avoid taking a position one way or the other simply because it involves clearly different kinds of issues which require thorough exploration.
Would this case be different if all the black citizens in Mobile organized a political party called the Black Political Action Group or something like that?
It would be different if it showed that the block voting was on the basis of ideas and the positions, the ideologies espoused by this particular organization, which crossed racial lines. The Constitution forbids invidious discrimination on the basis of race. The Voting Rights Act forbids invidious discrimination on the basis of race.
On race?
With respect to the constitutional rights of citizens of this country to vote in a block fashion, of course. The question is whether the state can reinforce and guarantee the defeat of the minority through a particular election form, which is what they have done in this case.
Oh, you don't agree with Mr. Ryan anymore.
There's been very little that we have agreed upon in the course of this litigation, Mr. Justice Marshall. I would like to close by pointing out that after the White and Whitcomb cases and the Voting Rights Act may have been analyzed to death, the issue from my client's standpoint very simply is whether or not they will be permitted to enter at last the mainstream of politics in the city of Mobile. If this court stands by its prior precedents in White, in Whitcomb, if it observes the congressional intent behind the Voting Rights Act, if it observes the precedent established in Gomillion versus Lightfoot and Arlington Heights regarding racially motivated state law, then given the findings of fact made by two concurrent courts below, the judgments below must be affirmed.
Well, do you have that finding by the district court? Look at page 32B of the jurisdictional statement. I thought that Judge Pittman came right up to the hurdle and then kind of backed off it, saying that Washington against Davis hadn't changed the dilution cases and it wasn't, no intent was required there until he didn't find it. See the top of page 32B there.
The argument, I think it's important to note, Mr. Justice Rehnquist, that the argument that the court is rejecting here is the argument that the defendant's city depended upon throughout trial, and that is that plaintiffs had to show intent in the origination, in the enactment of the statute. You'll notice that the court says that Washington versus Davis did not establish a new Supreme Court purpose test that requires initial discriminatory intent. The preceding paragraph contains the finding that there is a current condition of dilution of the black vote resulting from intentional state legislative inaction. Now, we fought through the lower courts, both the district court and the court of appeals, this argument that if we couldn't prove that in 1911 there was a racial motive involved, then we were out of court. And that is the issue that the district court was addressing in that passage.
Mr. Turner? We resume at 1 o'clock at this point.
Yeah.
continuing, or will you be reserving any time you have left? Or is, Mr. Turner, I guess it would appear that you're on deck. Got 2 minutes. Mr. Turner?
Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please the court. We appear as amicus to urge the court to affirm the judgments below in both numbers 77-1844 and 78-357, which will be argued next. Although there are slight differences in the legal analyses, which are apparent, I believe, from the briefs, we concur fully with the appellees that the maintenance of the at-large voting system for Mobile City Commission and School Commission in the circumstances of these cases violates the Equal Protection Clause and, alternatively and independently, the 15th Amendment. In the 14th Amendment, Equal Protection Clause, our analysis, like that of the Court of Appeals, accepts the fact that Washington versus Davis requires aggrieved parties to make a prima facie showing that the challenge system is purposefully discriminatory. Our submission is that the exhaustive records in these cases demonstrate such purposeful discrimination, that the careful factual findings made by the district court and thoroughly reviewed by the Court of Appeals should be given great deference, and that the at-large election system cannot be sustained in these circumstances because it impairs, if not submerges, meaningful access to the political process on the basis of race. The starting point of our analysis is White versus Register and its antecedents, Whitcomb versus Chavis. Our reading of White is that the ultimate inquiry is whether black citizens of Mobile City and County have been excluded from meaningful access to the political process because of their race. In White versus Register, with all justices joining us to this point, the court reiterated several factors alluded to in Whitcomb, and in judging whether the at-large scheme of issue has been purposefully operated and maintained, it is our view that reference to these factors set forth in White versus Register supplies the purpose evidence that Washington versus Davis requires.
How many municipalities in the country, if you know, approximately have at large systems of voting for their municipal governments?
I don't know, Mr. Justice
Most
Stewart.
Of them do, don't they?
I believe it to be a substantial
the majority?
Number. I don't know on that. The factual inquiry suggested in White against Register.
Well, before you go on
sure.
to that.
Yes, sir.
It's more likely than not, isn't it, that where the function is legislative and executive, that is to have the commissioners or councilmen assigned to be the chief executive of a particular department, that's a very, very large number of the municipal governments today, is it?
I think only a minority have what would be comparable to Mobile's commission system. Most of those that have that commission system, where legislative and executive functions are combined into one body, most of those are elected at large. However, there is a small number of those that are elected from districts and then assigned after election, as Mobile's former practice was, to particular executive responsibilities. And the first criteria, then, under White versus Register is that there be a present disparate effect. The at-large system in these cases has produced no black elected officials. Certainly no one contends that this is the end of the inquiry, but it is the beginning. the exclusion of one-third of all Mobile residents from representation in public office is consistent with the discriminatory purpose. The second White versus Register category of factual inquiry is a history of racial discrimination in the jurisdiction of such a nature, I would take it from Washington v. Davis, that it suggests purposeful action. This record documents a history of opposition to effective black exercise of the franchise that is both long and strong. And we have set out as much as we could in our brief some details of that history. The highlights include that right up until the time of trial, a single Mobile state senator had vetoed consideration of single-member districts for the city. Another highlight is that the state legislature, which would have to approve any changes in local government such as this, was singularly unresponsive. In 1970, for example, when all other barriers in Alabama...
There are Negroes in the state legislature.
There are now, yes, sir.
They've been there.
And they haven't...
Fred Gray has been there at least a dozen years.
Yes, sir, but I believe he was among the first. And we're talking about a history of the much longer than Mr. Gray's incumbency.
Mr. Turner, does the government think that the Fifth Circuit's opinion in Zimmer against McKeithen remains good law?
Our appraisal of the Zimmer case would run something like this. I'm not sure that every one of those factors has to be shown in a dilution case. However, they do, in Zimmer, set forth the kind of intense scrutiny that you have to undergo in a dilution case. We think that White versus Register and the three general criteria that I'm going through is a much more workable and useful approach.
Well, of course, workableness and usefulness aren't usually thought of as being necessarily constitutional factors. If you say something is more workable and more useful, does that mean you don't think Zimmer is any longer good law?
To the extent that it is inconsistent, and I think that it is in places, with the White versus Register criteria that I'm going through, it would not, in my judgment, be good law. As late as 1970, in the Alabama legislature, after all barriers to black voting in Alabama had been dealt with by federal court orders, there was one that remained, and that was the use of multi-member districts. And the Alabama District Court, in Sims versus Amos, finally had to adopt single-member districts for the Alabama legislature. And that's about the time that Mr. Gray and some of his associates became representatives. The third White versus Register criteria is the unresponsiveness of the elected officials to minority constituents. The question here, I take it, is what officials do after election and not what they promise at campaign time. Again, the details set forth in our brief show a pervasive lack of response to or interest in issues of concern to black Mobilians. No matter which level of elected officials you study, there is apparent evidence of unresponsiveness.
Of course, the White and Whitcomb cases involved a legislative apportionment or reapportionment.
Yes, sir.
I.e., it involved the context of representative democracy in the legislative area. And at least arguably, this system is more like a statewide election of a governor. Quite a different context, at least arguably. I mean, it's not all that clear that the concepts of the White and Whitcomb case are freely translatable into this situation.
Well, I can certainly agree with you as to the city case. That does have the additional element of the executive branch election, and one would have to make that translation. With respect to the school board case, and I realize you haven't heard argument on the facts yet, but you'll see there that it is pretty much a garden variety case.
More like the Hadley? More like...
Yes, sir.
Which, of course,
that the school board have the standard power.
Except for the White against Register and Whitman against Chavez, our cases have dealt with the one man, one person, one vote concept, which isn't no basis of the attack here, is it? On that basis, is it?
That's correct, Mr. Justice.
Would you think anyone would have a complaint to pursue Mr. Justice Stewart's point more fully than this hypothetical? The governor, the lieutenant governor, the attorney general, being regarded as three of the most important positions in the state government, surely, all elected at large, as they are, I suppose, everywhere, where they are elected. Mm-hmm. Doesn't it produce the same impact in a statewide situation?
Well, I would argue not, Mr. Chief Justice. The
why not?
Commission form...
Suppose the southern third of a state is all people of Spanish surnames and one or first or second generation Mexican-Americans. They aren't going to, on the theories that have been advanced here today, they aren't going to have much chance of electing a governor, a lieutenant governor, or an attorney general.
That's correct, if there were block voting on the basis of race. But again, here there is a legislative element to these positions. Local government is, historically at least,
the governor has some
representative government.
When he can veto a bill, that gives him...
Well, that's right. I guess we could divide the president up into five or six different offices if we followed that to its logical extreme. But I think we need not do that here. We conclude, in short, that all of the factors mentioned in White versus Register have been satisfied by the findings below, affirmed by the Court of Appeals. We urge that you give great deference to them. And turn to the 15th Amendment. If our conclusion is right, that the at-large system in Mobile has given white voters the means to abolish or abridge the effective black electoral participation because of race, it necessarily follows that violates the 15th Amendment. But a second part of our submission here is that independently, the 15th Amendment provides a basis for affirming the judgments below. Now, we get that out of the white primary cases. We say that in the Terry versus Adams, the Jaybird Club was a discriminatory private organization. But because the state magnified that discrimination and made it meaningful in elections, that this court turned it down and said that that violated the 15th Amendment. In many ways, the 15th Amendment is a much cleaner and more direct way of dealing with this question.
How many pages on a single word in any of those white primary cases that apply to a city? I have serious doubt they were limited to United States senators. Am I right?
I believe the Terry versus Adams was a county political organization,
but
that endorsed...
the election complained about was a national election. Wasn't it?
My recollection is that they endorsed candidates regularly in the Jaybird Club, which was an all-white club.
That's right, but
for local elections.
And the United States Senate wasn't involved?
I'm sure if you say it was, Mr. Justice, you have more experience than I. But the case will speak to itself.
General Turner, any distinction between the two cases that are before us, the one involving the commissioners and the one involving the school board?
No, sir. I think the same constitutional principles apply. There is the distinction that Mr. Justice Stewart pointed out which I acknowledge but do not accept as having constitutional significance. This is a classical, in my judgment, equity case. The record shows, and I urge you to read the record because it's very revealing, that in all forms of political activity in Mobile, Mobile City, Mobile County, Mobile County Commission, race is never very far from the surface. White voters, the majority, set aside, under this record, all other considerations when race is injected either in the form of the candidate or his or her supporters. Not only are blacks unable to win, the whites they support get the kiss of death, and the only way blacks have political influence is to bargain it away, and I think the 15th and 14th Amendment guarantee them more than that kind of closet courtship.
You haven't mentioned the Voting Rights Act, as your predecessor counsel did. Do you think that's involved here at all? Voting Rights Act of 1965.
The Section 2 of the 1965 Voting Rights Act, in terms very much like the 15th Amendment, prescribes discrimination in voting on the basis of race. Our original perception was that while certainly Section 2 would be violated if the 15th Amendment was violated, that you don't save much constitutional energy by addressing Section 2. Appellees will argue that that's incorrect, and certainly if they're right, you certainly ought to take a careful look at whether Section 2 is broader and gives more remedies than the 15th Amendment.
Was this 1965 legislative change, which formalized the specialization among the commissioners, submitted to the Attorney General under the Voting Rights Act?
It was, Mr. Justice, and we entered an objection to that, and it cannot legally at this time be implemented.
What happened? I mean, you entered an objection to it, and that made it invalid, didn't it? And
that's right. All the proposed change was in Act 823 was to make formal the practice which Mr. Ryan has described to you and other counsel spoke about. Because of our belief and our determination under the Voting Rights Act that this would lock in the commission system and the at-large voting that went with it, we could not be persuaded that the burden of proof had been carried by the submitting authority, and we entered an objection.
Well, the Attorney General entered an objection.
Right.
Which invalidated or at least suspended the operation of that legislation, didn't it?
In contemplation of law, yes. Mobile does not have specialized commissioners who run for special offices.
De jure.
De jure offices, yes.
I see.
Mr. Turner, do you agree with one of the earlier observations that if the residential pattern of Mobile was totally integrated, there would be a dilution of the voting strength that's being argued for here today of Negroes?
I agree with the answer that was given, that circumstance is so likely to be remote or so unlikely to exist that it's hard to frame an answer.
That's the objective. That's certainly the objective, is it not, to produce that kind of a city?
That would be greatly welcome.
Well, then doesn't the contrary, isn't it a corollary that the result you're arguing for would encourage the maintenance of ghettos in order to maintain voting strength?
It's really an academic question, Mr. Chief Justice. In Mobile, the district court found, quoting from a defendant's study by one of the universities, that Mobile was so residentially segregated that they couldn't divide it into three districts without one of them being majority black. I mean, it's that kind of intensive neighborhood discrimination that we're talking about, and that's why it's so awkward for me to try to answer a question postulated on the grounds that everything is salt and pepper. It isn't in this case.
Your predecessor answered, as I understood him, to the fact that if there were, in fact, complete dispersal, racial dispersal in all the geographic areas of the city, it would be highly unlikely that there would be block voting.
That's
that
correct.
The two go together.
I would associate myself with that response. Thank you.
Ryan, you have 2 minutes left.
Mr. Chief Justice, I wasn't sure that I had any minutes left, but let me answer one question for Mr. Justice Stewart. According to the municipal yearbook, and I guess it's fairly accurate, 67% of all the cities have elections apart. Now, the government here, in its brief, says the measure of the effect of an electoral system is not proportional representation, but fair representation. And I say to this court that as they review the record in this case, they're going to find that blacks have been fairly represented in Mobile. We quote on pages 10 and, I guess, 9 and 10, Reverend Hope, who heads the Nonpartisan Voters League, and he says that the current commissioners fairly represent the blacks in Mobile. And for 16 years, there was a commissioner, Mr. Langan, who was noted for the fact that he represented the blacks. So I don't think that the blacks were indeed their support, the kiss of death. He was there an awful long time. Now, in conclusion, I believe very strongly in the right to vote, in an equal vote. And I believe that that's what Mobile provides here. It provides equal access to the voting system, equal participation in that system, and an equal count of those votes. I think that's all the Constitution requires. And polarization is the only thing that they've offered here to prove invidious discrimination. And I don't think that's enough.
Thank you, Your Honor. Mr. Chief Justice, may it please the Court. My part of these proceedings concerns the constitutionality of the way Mobile County's school commissioners are elected. And since no later than 1836, these commissioners, the members of the Mobile County School Board, if you will, have been elected by the voters of the county at large. They were so elected when this action was brought by black residents of the county complaining that this at-large electoral system unconstitutionally diluted their voting power. As you have heard, blacks make up about a third of the population of Mobile County, slightly greater proportion of the population of the city itself, but it's around a third, the entire county. The district court sustained the plaintiff's complaint, and the Court of Appeals summarily affirmed. The issue that is posed by that decision is whether an at-large method
of election in a school district that has a significant black minority is unconstitutional merely because there is racially polarized voting and black minority candidates have not been elected to the board. However deeply rooted the at-large method of election may be in history and non-racial policy. I hope, in describing the proceedings and the decisions below, to demonstrate that the case poses the issue just that baldly. Then I'll try to explain why the resolution of that issue by the District Court and the Court of Appeals is inconsistent with the 14th and 15th Amendments and with this Court's decisions construing them. First, the facts and how they give rise to the issue I've stated. The long-standing commitment of Alabama to the at-large election of the members of the governing body of the Mobile County Schools is undoubted. The Mobile public school system was established in 1826, 28 years before a statewide system of schools, public schools, was established in Alabama. Either that original Enabling Act in 1826, it seems to be ambiguous, or if not that, then a replacement statute that was enacted in 1836 established a system of at-large election that has prevailed continuously since. As your honors may have learned from a perusal of the briefs, a statute that provided for single-member districts was enacted in 1975, but was voided because of a technical defect in the giving of notice. The original provision for the at-large election of Mobile County School Commissioners in the early 1800s, and the enactment in 1919 of the at-large election legislation that governs today, were not motivated by any consideration of the impact that at-large voting might have on black residents.
I suppose at the time of, whether it be 1836 or later, only white people voted, only white people were elected to the school board, and only white students went to the schools.
And no one thought of the possibility that blacks might vote at that time, in 1836. In 1919, when the present enabling statute was enacted, blacks had been effectively disenfranchised in Alabama by the Constitution of 1901, a situation that prevailed until about the time of the Second World War and shortly thereafter. Now, there's another key fact that appears from the record. Notwithstanding the history of which we're all aware and to which government counsel referred, of racial discrimination in many, many aspects of the life of Alabama, there are today no formal or informal barriers to full participation by black residents in the political process in Mobile County, including in particular school board elections. Blacks are able freely to register and to vote. They participate in both parties in the partisan process that leads to the election of school board members. Any candidate who's interested in running for the school board may do so. And it doesn't cost much to run for the school board.
Is there any controversy in this case about what you've just told us?
Up to this point, I am paraphrasing findings of the district court. I am paraphrasing findings. He did not advert to this other possible obstacle, the campaign cost. But in fact, there's testimony costed no more than $5,000, more usually about $2,000 to mount a perfectly effective campaign. The office...
They're non-paid jobs, have been up till very recently.
And these members perform no executive functions at all?
Well, the school board is like any other traditional American school board. It sets policies and it hires the executive. It hires the school superintendent. He's not elected separately. So so that executive responsibility ultimately is lodged in these school board members. And I take it, and this is highly personal knowledge, just from acquaintanceship with neighbors, that school board members are held very closely accountable for what goes on in schools by the by parents and others who are interested.
Does the board have any independent taxing power?
That I do not know. No, the answer to that is no.
Some states so, they do. Some
that's correct. Yes, yes. No, this board apparently is.
So, what are the functions of the members of the school board?
To sit and make policy about the schools, to decide on school construction, to hire the superintendent, certainly, and ultimately, I would guess, to decide on hirings, if it's a typical school board.
Well, that's my question. Does it select textbooks and those things, or is that done at the state level?
It does select textbooks.
So, and does it, I suppose, it promulgates rules and regulations, but except in that sense, doesn't have legislative power.
Legislative power, I'm not quite sure what that means in this context, but it does, whatever policy is to be made, it makes.
But
that is what legislation is.
It's making an administrative sort of body.
Yes, it combines the two functions. I think it's fair. I'm sorry that I'm afraid this was all taken much for granted and doesn't appear in the record.
Yes.
I apologize, but that is approximately the situation. Let me go on. In addition, another fact that appears, there's no white-oriented slating organization operating in Mobile County. Mobile County, the school elections, I should emphasize, are different from the city elections in that they are partisan. But the fact is that the only effective political endorsing organization is the Nonpartisan Voters League, which is a predominantly black organization.
They're partisan in this. A Republican and Democrat,
yes.
Or are they partisan?
No,
local
they are partisan in Republican and Democrat, which I think has traditionally meant Democrat.
Yeah.
The primary and the runoff of primary election are the decisive elections, it appears.
Yet the municipal elections that we just heard of are nonpartisan.
They are nonpartisan. They are nonpartisan. Now, as I've indicated, what I've recited heretofore are findings that made by Judge Pittman and accepted by the Court of Appeals. Judge Pittman also found that there was racially polarized voting in Mobile County. And he said further that this tendency to vote according to race made it difficult for a black person, a member of this minority, to be elected to the school board in an at-large election. In fact, 4 black candidates ran for the school board between 1962 and 1974. Each of them was running for office for the first time. Each of them reached the runoff. None was elected. Judge Pittman looked at these facts in the course of an analysis of the case that he felt himself compelled to follow because of the Court of Appeals decisions in Zimmer against McKeithen and other cases that have followed Zimmer, which have made the Zimmer factors decisive in Fifth Circuit voting dilution cases. You can't really understand what happened below without knowing something about these Zimmer factors. And the first Zimmer factor that Judge Pittman analyzed relates to minority access to this slating or candidate selection process. He made a finding, nominally a finding, that blacks were denied equal access to the slating or candidate selection process, I'm quoting there. But this finding was obviously a mere function of his view that potential black candidates were discouraged from running because of the history of losing elections. And the candidates lost those elections because they were members of a racial minority in a community in which there was racially polarized voting. I submit that in truth, that is to say nothing more than that racially polarized voting has prevailed in Mobile County. That is all that that lack of access conclusion, I will not dignify it by calling it a finding of the district court, amounts to.
It always, the slating is the sort of the nomination
for an organized group of candidates
whom in turn that group supports then.
That's right. But what the district judge was saying was he had found initially that there's nothing to prevent anybody from running in the Democratic primary. One is freely able to run, and there's no organization that controls who has access to the primary.
It just so happened that there weren't any Negroes in the Democratic Party.
I'm sorry, Your Honor?
Wasn't he relying on the fact that it just so happened that there weren't any Negroes in any Democratic Party?
They ran in primaries, Your Honor. They had not been elected. They had not been selected in the primaries. That's what he was relying on.
And it was the Democratic Party that controlled.
The Democratic,
when did a Republican ever get elected?
No, not at all. Not at all. It was the Democratic primary.
That's what he was talking about, right?
Yes, Your Honor, but he was talking about the habit of Democratic voters of voting according to race. That's all he was talking about. In the primary.
And the winner of the primary would be the slated candidate.
Would be the party candidate.
Who would be supported by the primary.
I understand that the slating criterion is derived from White Against Register has to do with an earlier stage in the process where a group was put up with some sort of sanction in the Democratic Party.
In that setting, it was the equivalent to nomination by an organized group.
But
Mr. Allen, I have joined opinions which refer to the term slating, and I must confess I am not entirely sure what it means. Could you give me your understanding of it?
My understanding is that an organization within the Democratic Party, the leadership, if one will, puts up a slate of candidates in the primary, and that slate, either nobody runs against them or they always win. That is my understanding from White Against Register, Your Honor.
Does that happen in this country?
No, it does not.
It's just the nominee. You run in the primary.
You run in the primary.
Nomination for election to the school board. If you win the primary, then your party presumably supports you.
And you win the election, as has been true up till now, if you're a Democrat.
Well, suppose in Mobile it's run the way it is, but in the adjoining city, Democrats always win the general elections, but the candidates that get put up are chosen by the Democratic Party in its own little conclave at a convention or in a back room somewhere. It's freely conceded that in the choosing of the Democratic candidates in the general election that there is racial voting.
Racial voting, nothing more than that?
Just that the people who are getting together, the Democratic Party, who are getting together in the back room, there are plenty of Negroes there, and but there are more whites.
Yes.
And in the back room, they have a show of hands, and they make nominations, and some are win and some lose, and always the whites win and the blacks lose.
Right.
And then the party comes out with this, if you want to call it, the slate of white candidates. Would that be the same answer?
I guess, Your Honor, I think it would depend on, I've not thought precisely about that, but it would depend, I take it, on whether one were at the poll of a real election or at the poll of the back room deal that determines
the only people who go into a Democratic primary are the registered Democrats, and the only people in the back room in the adjoining city are the Democrats who choose candidates.
Well, are some of the registered Democrats? I suggest that may make a difference, Your Honor. I suggest that may make a difference. That here, where one has unquestioned access to a very formal method of choosing candidates that amounts in this community to election.
Did the Negroes ever had access to that slate in Mobile?
The Negroes are able to run in the Democratic
primary without hindrance.
As far from my question as right from left. I'm talking about the slate. The group that is put up. The group that is always elected. The Negroes in Mobile have never gotten on that, have they?
They have not won a primary runoff of election. That is absolutely true, Your Honor.
No, sir. Please. Have they ever been on the slate?
They have never been the Democratic nominee. None of them has been the Democratic nominee.
The judge meant for the slate, didn't he?
If he meant anything by the slate, that had to be what he meant, and he meant again that it was a result of people's action in the polling booth that blacks were not able to be the Democratic Party nominee.
Did the polling booth pick the slate?
Yes, Your Honor. Yes, the Democratic primary. Yes.
You mean to tell me that the slate didn't pick a group of people in the Democratic Party? Then the Democratic Party in Mobile is different from every other Democratic Party.
Well, Your Honor, that is what this record shows, is that it was a free and formal primary election.
But has there ever been a Negro on the ballot for the general election?
In the general election? And in an at-large election? I just don't know whether other parties, the Republicans, have put up any. It was taken for granted on this record that the Democratic nomination amounted to election.
There's never been a Democratic candidate who's a Negro in the general election.
And for the school board. Mm-hmm. That is correct, Your Honor. No, they ran four times. I mean, different black candidates ran four times in the period we're concerned with. Each of them got to the runoff. Each of them was failed of nomination.
Now, let me be sure I understand. I understand your point. There is no slate-making committee within
No.
it. And therefore, what you're saying is that any time a Democrat is a candidate for the nomination of his party, he's just decided to run himself.
That's correct, Your Honor. Exactly correct.
Is that
exactly
that is
correct? Non-paying
situation.
Job. Anybody can, apparently five, six, eight people run each time for each of these positions. And
it's true that the judge knew more about it than you and I.
The judge knew more about it than you and I, but I really think I'm faithfully rendering what the judge said, Your Honor.
The usual reasons or at least what are thought to be the usual reasons, people running for a public office that pays $30,000-$40,000 a year or even $25,000 aren't present in the school board election.
No. That's correct. I mean,
it's just work and public service.
Public service, whatever motivates people to undertake public service. That is correct, Your Honor. Yes. Yes. I will skip over for a moment a couple of the Zimmer factors that the district judge looked to and just state that his overall conclusion was quite predictable. He paraphrased passages from some of this court's voting dilution opinions, and then he concluded that the plaintiffs had met their burden by showing an aggregate of the factors cataloged in Zimmer. And the court's remedy for this constitutional violation, it therefore found, was also predictable. Judge Pittman professed not to endorse quota voting or quota elections, but he adopted a plan that was designed, these are his words, to provide blacks a realistic opportunity to elect blacks to the Board of School Commissioners. In fact, two of the five single-member districts that he created would have weighted black populations of more than 55%, and the remaining three districts would have weighted black populations of less than 14%. The Court of Appeals affirmed this decision according to the Zimmer factors. It said that the district court had applied the proper standards and that his findings were not clearly erroneous, and it cited just one case, the decision of a different panel of the Court of Appeals in the city of Mobile's case. Now, a good deal of argument has gone on about exactly what the Court of Appeals thereby decided, and whether, in particular, the Court of Appeals decided, and whether it is necessary to make out a violation of the Equal Protection Clause and of the 15th Amendment to show purposeful discrimination on the part of the state. The correctness of that view, which I think clearly is correct, that purposefulness is required, is contested. So let me turn first, by way of analysis of that, to a couple of points that I think cannot be contested. One is that no one has asserted or even suggested that the at-large system here was conceived in racial animus with a deliberate purpose of discriminating against blacks or submerging the votes of blacks. A second is that the district court made its decision on the basis of an understanding that the Court of Appeals' Zimmer factors capture the effects of an at-large system on minority voters and candidates, not on the understanding that those factors go to an intent to discriminate. At that point, we get into more contentious ground. At one point in his opinion, Mr. Justice Rehnquist referred to the parallel point in his opinion in the City of Mobile's case. At one point in his opinion, removed from his Zimmer analysis, Judge Pittman said that it was possible to perceive a present purpose to dilute black votes based on legislative inaction, based on the failure of the legislature to do anything about this at-large system that had been created so many years before. I can think that the person reading that passage, at page 34A of the appendix in our case, will agree that this is no finding of a present purpose to discriminate, even though that's how the plaintiffs now like to describe it. It's in a section entitled Conclusions of Law. It's not preceded by any factual analysis. It's exactly the same language that's used in the factually different City of Mobile case. It simply, I think, fairly cannot be considered a finding to which any deference is owed.
Page 34A of not of the jurisdictional statement.
No, of the appendix.
Of the appendix. And what is the middle paragraph?
Yes, yeah, the middle paragraph, or the last two paragraphs, Your Honor.
Right.
Mr. Allen, I suppose your answer to a question Mr. Justice Black asked in the other case might be somewhat different than the one was given. I think you take it there is a difference between this case and the other case. Or maybe you don't.
In what respect, Your Honor?
There are differences.
I
that have any significance on the outcome? If we decide one way, do you think they both should go the same way?
Yes, I'm persuaded of that. Yes, Your Honor. Yes.
Well, then, if there's evidence to support the finding that there was a deliberate maintenance of the at-large system in the other case, what is the relevance of the absence of such evidence in this case?
I didn't suggest that there was. I'm sorry. I can understand Your Honor's question now.
What
I did not mean to suggest
that?
The presence of such evidence. I merely meant that there was no real factual analysis that preceded this
there
statement in
case.
Either case.
So there wasn't
in
the
either.
Other case.
No.
There were bills proposed that were not adopted and that sort of thing, but there was not that.
There was not that same kind of thing here. That's quite right, Your Honor. Yes. So to that extent, it may be different. But
in other words, if this finding were supported by evidence, would that make your legal position any different?
If there were some evidence that the legislature had deliberately acted lately to ratify or otherwise to confirm.
Let's take a hard case. Suppose somebody said, let's have change the system so that there would be some kind of a proportional representation. And everybody said, well, let's not do that. Then you might get some blacks on the school board. Would the case be different?
I can imagine a case of that sort being different. I think it is a dangerous inquiry to get into, Your Honor.
Well, but arguably the other case is more like that than this.
Well, it may. I know it's just not that well versed in the legislative goings on in the other case to know that. But I did not mean to imply that in what I said in comparing the two. I was at the point where we were talking about whether a present purpose to discriminate was found here. And in its opinion, in the City of Mobile's case, which was cited in this case as decisional authority, the Court of Appeals was more specific. It said, in that case, that when you've aggregated these Zimmer factors, and they add up to voting dilution, then, at least when the dilution is long-standing, there's the requisite intent if the legislative body has not acted to change the situation. That is substantially the reasoning of the Court of Appeals, if I understand. But that sort of intent, I submit, is a construct. It's artificial. It's the same as saying, really, that the Zimmer factors themselves are enough if the system of at-large elections is old enough to permit of this.
I take it that one of the operative facts in the exclusion or the failure of Negroes to be nominated or to be elected, one of the operative facts is the block voting.
That is all, I submit, Your Honor.
Yes,
that is
but it. You accept that.
Oh, yes. Oh, and, yes. There seems to be evidence
there is purposeful exclusion of Negroes from office. But I suppose your answer to that is, well, the state's just not responsible.
The state is not responsible. I think none of this court's decisions comprehends as state action the action of the voters.
Because there's no question whatsoever, I take it from the arguments of anybody, that at some point in this process there's purposeful exclusion. It's just a question of by whom.
By whom, and it's by individual voters voting their will.
That argument about Smokey might become relevant.
Well, I suggest not, Your Honor.
The 15th Amendment doesn't require state action.
It requires action by the state or the United States, Your Honor. It says 50 shall not be denied or abridged by the United States or any state on account of race, color, or
previous condition of service. As opposed to you can get the state action, I take it is that here's a state that, or a city that provides a primary mechanism for the selection of candidates and permits and within that system, deliberate discrimination goes on by the people who enter the ballot box.
But they seem to vote according to race in at least some races. That is correct, Your Honor. Yes, that is what it amounts to.
Very well, Mr. Allen. Mr. Snapper?
Mr. Chief Justice, may it please the Court. These two cases raise a variety of different issues, and I thought it might be useful to briefly sketch out what they are. First, there is a statutory claim in these cases, which, as the Chief Justice noted in the last argument, ordinarily is a claim that is resolved prior to the decision on any constitutional claims. We allege that under Section 2 of the Voting Rights Act, the at-large elections used in these cases violates Section 2, and we rely in particular on a statement by Attorney General Katzenbach, which is quoted by this Court in footnote 31 in Allen, which says that Section 2 covers purpose or effect, that it has, I would paraphrase that, the same meaning that Section 5 does, but with a different burden of proof. Second, there is a constitutional claim under White against Register. Now, with regard to that, we are in agreement with the government that we seek only to apply decisions of this Court in White and before and after it, which I think are fairly well established. We are in disagreement with the government, which reads some intent requirement into White. We see no intent requirement in White, and we've set out at length in our brief why. Third, we claim that in these cases the systems of election are maintained because of a deliberate decision to keep blacks from public office. So we maintain that the hypothetical posed by Justice Stevens is in fact the case. Excuse me?
Who has continued to keep them from voting? The city? The state?
Well, our answer would be slightly different in the two cases. I mean, we would say the state in the constitutional sense, but I think that it's more complex than that.
Well, who is maintaining this discrimination?
Right. In the city case, as Mr. Justice Stevens noted, there's direct testimony by members of the legislature who were there at the time the decisions were made not to authorize single-member districts, that decision was made for racial reasons. And they were made essentially by the members of the legislature from Mobile. That's the way the legislature operates.
And Mobile controls the legislature.
Well, that seems to be an important part of the analysis of the school board case. It's not critical to the analysis of the city case. In the school board case, we have a rather complicated series of facts which are set out in our brief involving the introduction and passage of deliberately defective legislation in the legislature in order to prevent the federal litigation from going forward. That becomes, I think, the operative decision. And as a practical matter, those decisions were made by the defendant school board members. And it's their contention below, and I think correctly, that they were calling the shots in the legislature about what was being introduced and passed.
Ultimately, it's the voters, isn't it? I mean, except for this so-called block voting, there's nothing the legislature could do in the state capitol or the city or the school board could do. We could prevent Negroes being elected.
Well, I don't want to recount the history of discriminatory devices that have existed now down over the years.
I think
this intentional scheme to discriminate on the part of the state wouldn't work if you didn't also have block voting.
You have to, and that's within the voluntary control of each individual voter.
Mr. Justice Stewart, I think that if we are right, and Mr. Justice Stevens' hypothetical is the case, namely that this election system is being maintained for the express purpose of keeping blacks from being elected, a purpose on the part of the officials of the state of Alabama, that violates the 14th and 15th Amendments of the Constitution. Nothing in the decisions of this court suggests that a racial motive, which is not benign in nature, but here clearly vicious, can somehow or other be sanctioned because it only works because of private discrimination as well. I think that it would be analogous to a situation where, for example, the state, as happened in 1903, expressly authorized the state parties to exclude voters on the basis of race, and the parties did that. I mean, there was action which was less state action than the actions of the legislature, although it may be for constitutional purposes, that was also state action that the party did. But I don't think that part of the causal mechanism is of any relevance. I think the state acts from a hostile racial motive, that violates the 14th and 15th Amendments, and that would be the end of the case. In addition,
then I take it relate the historic hostile motive of what existed back in 1826 and 1836 to a hostile motive today because the legislature did not change the structure to meet a different kind of discrimination.
We have a situation here exactly like Arlington Heights. In Arlington Heights, there had been a zoning classification. The court's opinion showeth not when in origin. But a dispute arose as to the decision of Arlington Heights not to change the zoning classification. And the court held, and I think properly, that if that refusal to change had been racially motivated, the zoning would have been unconstitutional, and it was of no importance when or how that zoning classification had come into existence. And that's our contention here. We just ask you in that regard to follow on and hide.
How many legislators do you need to maintain your point, a majority?
I think the question would be who the people were that were actually making the decision. If the legislature effectively delegates control over this to a single legislator, as indeed exists in Alabama,
one legislator?
The way the system works is a bill of this sort affecting only Mobile, would have to be approved by the legislative delegation from Mobile. And the courtesy rule in the Senate is that any single member of the state Senate can veto a Mobile bill. And that's precisely what happened. So it was one senator. The question isn't one of numbers. The question is who is making the decision on behalf of the state.
So you can say that the whole legislature of Alabama, including Fred Gray, is guilty of racial prejudice.
I wouldn't characterize it in that way. But
I wouldn't think you could.
Your Honor, if the state of Alabama and the legislature delegates the authority for making a decision to one member of the legislature, and the district court found that that was the case, and it's not a finding that's contested, then the motives of the person that makes that decision is the operative motive for the state of Alabama.
And you're bound by that.
What? And I think you're bound by that.
In other words, when the legislature as a whole, in your hypothetical, or your explanation, delegated that power to one man, they, in advance, adopted the action he was taking and the motives that motivated him.
Well, they could have changed their mind, but they didn't. I mean, it seems to me no other conceivable rule is possible. I mean, otherwise you could simply nullify the 14th Amendment by systematically referring any legislation that you wanted to undertake with a discriminatory motive to a single legislator who would then act from racial motives, and then you'd come in and defend a suit and say, well, you know, it was only Senator so-and-so, and the rest of us never even thought about it. I mean, that just would be, I think, a rule that would be an invitation to evasion of the constitutional commands in this area. Finally, I was just trying to sketch out here what the arguments were presented by the case. There is a claim under the 15th Amendment. And as I think Mr. Turner noted, that is somewhat narrower in its impact than our claim under White against Register, because, of course, it would be limited to racial issues. Both the government and we contend that the 15th Amendment is not limited to instances of discriminatory purpose. I think we have a somewhat different approach to it. We rely particularly on the legislative history of the 15th Amendment, and the concern on the part of Congress by adopting the 15th Amendment to ensure that blacks were armed with an effective franchise by which they could protect themselves against government discrimination. We think the record clearly shows that they don't have that in this case. The government advances an argument, I think, closer to that suggested by Mr. Justice White, to wit, that we have something here akin to the Terry against Adams, and that, as I think you were articulating it, the Democratic Party has picked its candidates on the basis of race, and that decision is effectively state action because it controls the outcomes of the election.
But is there any issue here as to, is there any claim that the party primary, the Democratic primary, is not a free and open primary?
It is as free and open as the primary in Bayer County, Texas, which this court unanimously held violated White against Register and White against
legislating there.
Not in Bayer County, only in Dallas County.
B-E-X-A-R.
Right. It's pronounced there.
What?
San Antonio. Yes. Yeah. There's an express finding, in fact, that there isn't slating in that case, and I think that's quite clear.
And there wasn't?
There was slating in Dallas. There was not slating in Bayer County. There's not slating here.
There's just a nomination by a party primary in which any qualified Democrat can vote.
That's an accurate statement.
Regardless of his race.
Yes.
And that's all conceded, isn't it?
Yes, I think we're in agreement.
There's no secret inside group that slates is our...
No, there's not.
Or no claim that there is.
No claim of that. Well, there's a little claim of that on the part of the other side, but they certainly present that on their own.
Will anybody get on the general election ballot except by a primary?
In the case of the school board, I don't believe so. My understanding is that it's just an ordinary primary. You've got to be nominated by one of the parties. And nomination by the Democratic Party is the equivalent of election.
Well, what happens after the Democratic primary for the school board?
Well, there's a general election, but it's often uncontested. It was uncontested this year, for example.
Well, if it is contested, how do you contest it?
you get the nomination of the Republican Party.
What about the nonpartisan party?
The nonpartisan Voters League isn't a party. It was a private organization that endorsed people.
Can they get somebody on there?
Only if they can get a party to nominate them. They're like the FFL or any public interest group. They don't have a party. It has to be a party. Well, those are the four claims before the court.
Is there any mechanism for being nominated by a petition after the primary? Or
the record doesn't reflect that. Excuse me? There may be a procedure of that sort of. It was not part of the case as it was litigated below. It's not.
You haven't quite explained on your theory why you think the 15th Amendment, your 15th Amendment claim is any different than the 14th Amendment claim.
Oh, I'm delighted
with
to see
respect
that.
To how the state is involved.
I'm
the
sorry.
State, the denial of the right to vote still has to be by the state. So how?
That's right.
So tell me how the state is involved in the 15th Amendment violation.
Well, our claim is that the 15th Amendment prohibits the state from adopting election systems which have a discriminatory effect, and this we claim is such a system. That doctrine is somewhat different than the doctrine we find in White against Register for a variety of reasons, not the least of which is that it is White is limited to the problem of at-large election systems. The 15th Amendment would cover any election law, but on the other hand, the 15th Amendment is limited to questions of race.
You mean maintain? Don't you?
For purposes of my motive argument, I would say adopted or maintained, yes. Yes. With regard to the 15th Amendment, we place particular emphasis on the phrase, on two things. First, the use of the phrase abridged in the language of the 15th Amendment. If you recall the history of the times when the 15th Amendment was adopted, there was nothing then to which that could have corresponded. The South was under the control of the Union Army, and blacks were free to vote everywhere. The concern, I think, we think of Congress in adding the word abridged was not merely that when the whites came back into power after Reconstruction, they would strip blacks of the right to vote at all, but that new forms of discrimination, new devices might be adopted that had these kinds of impact. I know, Justice White, that there was, an understandable concern in Washington against Davis about the ramifications of having an effect rule under the 14th Amendment, because it would call into question a wide variety of governmental programs, housing, taxes, and all sorts of things. We think that those problems aren't raised by the effect rule we urge under the 15th Amendment. Obviously, its scope would be limited to claims of discrimination in voting, and we think it appropriate that that blacks be protected in voting to a greater degree than other areas.
The state is sufficiently involved if it maintains a system which permits individual discrimination at the polls.
Yes. I mean, that's right.
That's it, isn't it?
That is it. The role of the state is in creating and maintaining the at-large system. Now, I'd like to turn at this point. Well, there's one other point, I think, which does separate us from the appellants in both of these cases. I think we have a very different view of what the role of the appellate courts are in resolving these cases. Listening to their argument, I had the sense that we were back in the trial court and that you were sitting in UC Prius or perhaps riding circuit as occurred in the old days. I think, as Justice Stevens pointed out, that the role of the court is more limited, that absent some sort of palpable error, which I don't think is present here, that the findings of the trial court really do have to be accepted. And in our view, they're sufficient to mandate judgment for us.
What if we concluded that the trial court did not find that there was an intent to discriminate, and that the Court of Appeals concluded that there was an intent to discriminate? Now, is that a two-court finding that we ought to affirm?
If you hold that the, let me make sure I've got this right, that the district court didn't find intent, but
right.
The Court of Appeals did find intent.
Right.
Well, that's not under the two-court rule. I think, in all candor, that the practice of the court in that situation is to come very close to putting itself in the shoes of the Court of Appeals. So I don't think the same deference would exist if it were merely a court of appeals finding of intent.
There is a problem here in what standards are applied, isn't it? Because Washington against Davis came down after this litigation had started, and as I understand it, the Nevitt foursome or whatever it was decided at an intermediate stage of this litigation, so that you have a little bit of a shifting of legal standards.
Washington against Davis was decided before the cases went to trial. And so at the time the cases went to trial, there was already a dispute between the parties as to whether you needed intent under the 14th Amendment. We maintain there, as we do now, that the Equal Protection Clause has two distinct branches.
I thought the litigation was 8 or 9 years old.
No. Surprisingly enough, this case is only 4 years old.
Bearing in mind that this is a direct appeal.
Yes.
What is it that we are limited from changing under your concept of the two-court rule?
Well, I think the ordinary practice of the court is the same.
The first thing we have to pass on is the constitutionality. It's the first thing we have to pass on a direct appeal, don't we? And certainly we don't have to follow the two-court rule on constitutionality, do we?
Well, that's several questions. Let me try to answer them all. First, I think that the first question you probably ought to reach, consistent with the general practice of the court, would be the statutory issue. And I say that not because we prefer to win on one theory or another.
It's a direct appeal.
It is a direct appeal, but I think the court's normal...
What is before us on a direct appeal? The constitutionality of a statute.
Well, I think we are entitled, as we are in any case, to urge in support of the decision below any ground that was raised below.
Sure, but the statutory ground was raised below. I don't think you had the right to prevent us from considering the constitutionality of the statute that's involved.
We have no right to do that, no intention of trying to do that.
I meant only to recall
to you the normal practice of the court, which is to decide statutory issues first. We have no preference on that. If you want to decide the most sweeping constitutional issue, then the narrow constitutional issue, then the statutory issues.
As long as we decide for you.
Well, that's our position. That's our position. I think you had another question. I don't think I fully answered.
I think our
position would be that the two-court rule is as applicable here as always. The two-court rule does not preclude you from defining constitutional issues. It only suggests that with regard to specific factual matters that you generally uphold the findings of the two courts below unless there's an unusual circumstance.
Mr. Schnapper, could I ask you a question?
Yes.
Your opponent, Mr. Allen, has said that when you really analyze the facts, what the case boils down to is block voting plus that large and a large system plus the minority of blacks in the voting population. And in your brief, you emphasize those very facts,
yes,
distinguishing other cases. Do you think those facts are enough?
It's our contention they are indeed enough. And they are enough under White against Register, under Section 2 of the Voting Rights Act and under the 15th Amendment, although for somewhat different reasons because the rationale of each of those rules is different. With regard to that, I think perhaps I should answer a question that Mr. Justice Rehnquist asked earlier about Zimmer against McKiffin. Both parties in the courts of appeals relied on Zimmer against McKiffin, and you will find in the brief for the school board a statement which says they think Zimmer against McKiffin is correct. I think we were all obligated to operate in the context of Zimmer in the courts of appeals. I think here it is indeed our view that Zimmer was too constricted in its application of White against Register and that less proof is required than is elaborated in Zimmer. We also are in disagreement with the part of Nevitt against Sides, which was subsequent, which holds that intent is in fact necessary under White or Zimmer. And we've laid out the reasons for that contention in our brief at length. Ron, I'd like to touch very briefly on our claim under the Voting Rights Act, which we think is the issue which the court ought to begin. We've noted that the legislative history on this matter, such as it is quite clear, that Attorney General Katzenbach testified on the very issue of whether or not the statute covered purpose and effect and said that it did. We think, therefore, that the substantive standard under the Voting Rights Act, under Section 2, is exactly the same as the substantive standard under Section 5, which is to say that if the election law permits white voters to nullify the electoral preferences of blacks, that it falls under the Voting Rights Act. The difference, the only difference that we see between Section 5 and Section 2 is a procedural one, that the burden of proof is on the state under Section 5, the burden of proof is on the plaintiff under Section 2.
Well, your opponent cites Senator Dirksen's statement that Senate Section 2 is just a restatement of the 15th Amendment.
Well, I think it's almost. I think the word almost appears in there. I think the value of that is a little hard to know because nobody, I think, at that point necessarily knew what the 15th Amendment meant.
But Attorney General Katzenbach did.
And he said purpose or effect. He was quite clear about that.
Who passed his laws, the Attorney General or the Congress?
Current wisdom is the Congress does it.
But not a single senator.
But not in this Senate. Not in the Senate. If we're right in our contention that the standard of Section 2 and Section 5 are the same, then I think the result of the case would be clear. I think if Alabama had attempted to switch to this system from a single-member system, there'd be no question that they couldn't do it. And we think Section 2 invalidates it for that reason.
Thank you, gentlemen. The case is submitted. We'll hear arguments next in...